The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today on Campus Voices for his third appearance and his final appearance before he moves home to England is my former colleague and good friend, Alex Brown. Welcome to Campus Voices.
Thank you for having me back again, Richard. So, and I assure you this will be my last time as I am off to England.
Alex has been a faculty member and an administrator in the Lerner College of Business and Economics. He's been up at the Wharton School, and he and I are both soccer fans or football fans. But I think the real passion of your life is horses.
And interestingly enough, horses and the convergence of horses and technology and the internet, which is the passion that we share and sort of connected us, I think, you know, some 20-some years ago.
So in addition to the book that you wrote about Barbaro several years ago and your work as an exercise rider, we're going to talk about this later, but right. One of your big projects is working with people to learn more about equine slaughter and the humane treatment of horses in rodeos, at racetracks, after their career is done, and those kinds of things.
Right. Yeah, and it's a passion that I've only really gotten involved in perhaps the last 6 or 7 years. I've been a horseman for all my life, but this is something that I've become particularly interested in, and thankfully you let me talk about a project that I'm about to launch in that regard a little bit later.
Well, since you start off as a horseman, let's go ahead and start the interview with some standard horseman, sportsman things as we're talking with you in the weeks between the 2015 Kentucky Derby and the 2015 Preakness. It was quite a race, the Derby.
Yeah, the Derby this year, I think, was a very good race. It was won by American Pharoah, who was the favorite going in. So it's kind of good to see a big horse race where the favorites really did sort of justify their billing going into the race. So American Pharoah won it as the favorite. Dortmund was third as the second choice. And Firing Line finished between them, and Firing Line's form showed that he could really compete with Dortmund. So it really was a formful race, and that made it, from my perspective, more enjoyable.
And I was really excited to see Frosted come up hard charging for fourth. Don't get any money that way, but...
Yeah, I mean, he ran well for an also-ran, let's put it that way. You know, you come from the back of the pack, pick up some of the pieces, and that's basically what he did. The front three ran the whole race as the front three, and they were in their own race the whole way, as far as I'm concerned anyway.
Now, Frosted's owner, like some of the other colts owners, is going to rest him from the Preakness and hope he does better in the Belmont. But American Pharoah, Firing Line, and Dortmund are all going to be back for the upcoming Preakness.
And this will be quite interesting, because I will say all three of those horses had tough races in the Derby. This wasn't a Derby. Let's say, you know, obviously my personal favorite winner was Barbaro. When he won the Derby, he won so easily that, you know, you figure the race is going to take anything out of him. Obviously, what happened to Barbaro in the Preakness was a tragedy, but he came into the Preakness looking like a fresh horse himself. American Pharoah, Victor Espinosa, his rider, really got stuck into him severely to get him to win that race. Firing Line, second, he was all out, claws and daggers, to duke it out with American Pharoah. And Dortmund was weakening right there at the end, having run a real tough race. So these three horses are the three best going into the Preakness. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But they will meet some fresh horses, and those fresh horses might have an edge.
I was surprised to see Dortmund and American Pharoah both entered, because they're both trained by Baffert, but of course it's an owner and trainer decision.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised too, quite honestly. I thought if American Pharoah would win the Derby as he did, his Triple Crown quest would be made easy, because Baffert wouldn't go to the Preakness with the other horse. But as you say, they have separate ownership interests, and, you know, Baffert's doing what his owners want him to do.
Alex mentioned Barbaro's very, very bad break in the Preakness. And that's one of the ways that a lot of people around America got to know Alex Brown, Alex Brown Racing, Tim Woolley Racing, where Alex was working at the time, working on the website. That's where you put up all this information as people were watching for months to see how Barbaro's health was doing. And it ties in really well with your upcoming projects and your coming projects, right, like looking for the humane treatment, right, of horses.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just a quick sort of look back. You know, Barbaro, he won the Derbies undefeated and looked spectacular going into the Preakness. I was teaching here at the time my what is now a digital marketing course. At that time, we called it technology information applications in something or other or something. But I was teaching that course, and as part of teaching that course, I used this as a case study to sort of how to build community around a website. Let's follow Barbaro as he prepared for the Preakness. And then, obviously, we know what happened. But that project sort of then evolved into a huge horse welfare community. It went from 3 visits a day to 10, 15,000 visits a day. And the project is still ongoing, you know, however many years after Barbaro unfortunately passed away. But it's made me really focus on some of these horse welfare issues and become, some would say, one of the experts in that particular field. And it's great. Horses have been great to me my entire life. So if I can give back just a little bit, I think that's pretty cool.
Well, I would say you're one of the experts in the field. I mean, I don't know anyone else who's given up a career at the Wharton School at the University of Delaware to spend a year or 18 months, whatever it was. You spent a year
Two years working for Steve Asmussen on the road, different racetracks, just doing additional research before I wrote the book initially, as well as really building out my network. So I know people all around the country that focus on these issues. And I know the issues from different parts of the country in different cultures, like equine cultures that I talk about in my forthcoming project. I mean, things are very different when you're a cowboy in Oklahoma than they are when you're an English rider in Pennsylvania. And to understand those differences, I think, is important.
Folks, the point is that Alex is looking at the welfare of horses, not just a racehorse who happens to be injured in a race, but all the different horses, right, and all the different uses that we have of them here in the United States.
Right. You know, horses have a useful life for a period of time, and they live long lives. So oftentimes in our disposable society, we tend to, once the horse has fulfilled its usefulness for 3 or 4 years, we sell it on, and we don't then worry about, well, what happens to it after that sale. And the reality is, for a lot of horses, things aren't that good, and there's this sort of underground sort of horse meat market that a lot of the men end up sort of moving into, which is just not a good thing. In my book, it's you know, this, if this persists, it should persist because we all know it persists. It shouldn't persist as it does now as an underground sort of system that we have.
It's an underground system in the United States because we've outlawed horse slaughter, which means our horses have to go to Canada or Mexico to be butchered for meat.
That's pretty much correct. I mean, I could go into a long explanation of why what you said isn't quite correct.
Legally.
But yeah, pretty much the way the legislation's written now on the appropriations bill, we cannot have slaughter in this country for human consumption. So we ship them across to Mexico and to Canada.
What is it that makes horses different from, say, cattle?
Well, horses are classified livestock. So this is one of the big arguments. If we slaughter livestock, then horses are really no different. But some argue that horses actually should be considered more as a companion animal, and we name horses and we treat them as pets and so on and so forth. So in that regard, they're separate to cattle and pigs and sheep. Horses, you know, from a slaughter standpoint, they're not, you know, the long necks, they get nervous and stuff, whereas typically cattle are more docile and so forth. Horses help build the country. You know, we owe our current existence to the horse. But I think the most important issue is the horse is not born as a food animal. So therefore, there's no traceability tracking the horse whilst it's being an equestrian animal or whatever it is. You know, it's getting drugs. There's no tracking of those drugs and so forth. Then boom, all of a sudden it's a food animal in the slaughter supply chain, and there's no drug history. And that's a huge problem.
And some of those drugs that a horse would get for an injury right. are outlawed in
the food supply chain. Absolutely. Bute is the most common drug any horse gets. But it's like us having an aspirin. If you can look me in the eye and say, in your life, you've never had an aspirin, I'd be like, well, you've led a pretty wacky life. But that's kind of the same as the horse. Whether you're a pet, a rodeo horse, or a racing horse, or any kind of horse, it'd be very it would be extraordinary if you never had a tab of bute. And there's no quarantine period for bute. If you've had a tab of bute, you're not eligible for slaughter.
What we're also getting at is, I think horses are different because of the relationships we humans have with them. It's
right.
In some ways, they're like our companion and working dogs more than they are like a cow or a pig.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. But I also think more so we owe a debt of gratitude to the horse, because if it wasn't for the horse, we wouldn't be sat here today chatting away with all the technology we have, because up until the Industrial Revolution, the horse was the most important piece of technology we had.
And if you don't believe that, how do you measure the power of an engine today?
It's all by horsepower. And, you know, there's an interesting quote that I use in my project that I'm about to launch, where Henry Ford announces the Model T Ford, which is the car that sort of is available to the masses, right? So it enables a lot of people now to drive. And one of the things he said in the press conference is, I'm trying now to take the burden of the farmer for having to breed all these horses. You know, I'm not saying Henry Ford wanted to start the horse slaughter issue that we have today, but basically that was the beginning of this particular issue.
The project that you keep referring to is a video sort of compendium of all your research that you're hoping to have up very shortly on your website. Would be a resource for people who are looking into the horse slaughter issue.
Right. Yeah, and my goal is, you know, there's lots of video out there, lots of stuff on YouTube that tells you how horrific slaughter is and horse slaughter. Any kind of slaughter is horrific, right? So lots of stuff put out there by animal rights groups and so forth. But I think that's emotionally charged. I think the only people that watch that are other animal rights folks. And that's not my goal. My goal is to create a resource that everybody would watch and learn from, and then make an informed decision on whether this is right or wrong. And if that informed decision is that it is wrong, feel that they're enabled intellectually to start doing something about it. Right now, I believe the system works because of emotion, misinformation, and a lot of ignorance on the side of a lot of people involved in horses. So my goal is to create something that people will watch and learn from.
One of the things that struck me about, I've seen some of the early rushes, if you will, from your videos, is that, you know, you really talk about how horse slaughter, particularly for meat, is driven by economic demand. I mean,
right.
The European Union and other countries, horse meat is one of the things people eat.
Yeah, I mean, one of the myths is we have horse slaughter because we need a means to get rid of all the broken down, crippled, old and aged horses. But the reality is, the horse slaughter market is just like another segment of demand for the horse industry. The number of horses that we slaughter is basically dependent on the demand for the horse meat in these various foreign countries, some in Europe, some in Asia, and so forth. So, you know, if we slaughtered 150,000 horses last year, it's not because there was 150,000 horses that nobody wanted. It's because the demand for meat was met by 150,000 horses. So it's a demand-driven business.
One of the facts that you cite in this video is that right now we have about 9.2 million horses in America, and about 150,000 are slaughtered, are sent to commercial slaughterhouses a year, and we don't know exactly how many horses a year die of other causes, but it's under a million.
Right.
So I guess another question to ask is, how is this different from, say, a dog breeder culling undesirable dogs, or, you know, from a litter, I mean, from an AKC breeder, or...
Right. I mean, I don't really know the differences, simply because I'm not as familiar with the issues with dogs and cats and so forth, but a couple of things that I would sort of say. I talk about horse slaughter. It's horse slaughter for human consumption. That's very different from humane euthanasia, which I presume is more the outcome in the dog issues and the cat issues. They have to put them down because there's too many of them. we're talking about shipping horses over long distances in an environment in which they're absolutely never been treated to up until this point that they're in this horse slaughter supply chain. So they're in kill auctions where they're aggregated into these kill pens. This is a horrific experience prior to them getting to the slaughterhouse. And then the slaughterhouse experience itself is not designed for the horse's anatomy versus a cow's anatomy or something.
But I think like that's a very good point, too, in that a horse's, I hate to say personality, but a horse's mental makeup and the way a horse interacts with the world is very different than the way a cow or a sheep would.
Cow and sheep are bred for the food chain. Years and years of breeding and breeding. So they try to breed the sort of breed docility or whatever the right term is into the animal.
Stupid.
Whereas horses are just one thing removed from the wild animal. So that's a big difference. And then just the neck, so on and so forth. Just makes
Horses too, I mean, they're bred to be worked individually or in small teams.
Yeah.
And they're bred to be trainable.
Or bred to be super fast. Bred to be very athletic or bred to be this, that, and the other, but not bred to just sit there and have a captive bolt pushed through its brain.
But even a horse that's being bred for the track is still one of the things they value is the intelligence and how they can train it
absolutely.
To respond to the jockey.
And that's that training and trust. Yeah. That's two things right there, right? So the horse trusts us, but the training and so on and so forth.
I apologize if it sounds like I'm starting to come down on the emotional side, but I mean, to me, a horse is just part of our culture. I mean, it's part of all the different ways. I know in your film you talk about all the different cultures that in just North America have used the horse.
Yeah. I mean, you know, before the Spanish came up through Mexico, the Native Americans didn't have the horse. They were a hunter-gatherer culture. So that completely changed their way of life and how they could hunt the buffalo and stuff like that. Obviously, for us, the English and Europeans on the East Coast used the horse to get to the West Coast. One example that I use right in the video is Wells Fargo. They wouldn't exist today if it wasn't for the horse. I mean, the horse enabled them to set up a banking infrastructure for the gold rush, a telecommunications infrastructure with the Pony Express. You know, farming and agriculture uses a different type of horse, you know, the big draft, the percheron and stuff that, up until the 1930s, there were huge populations of those working animals out in the fields. And again, they're another breed that sort of really, really suffered.
When we were talking about your project a few weeks ago, one of the things you told me about was the story of how, if you will, factory slaughter began. And it wasn't just Henry Ford with his automobile.
Right.
It was a whole series of historical events that happened in the early 1900s.
I mean, I'm a bit of a geek, right? So I get quite excited when I learn
this
stuff.
That's where we get along.
But it was actually fascinating because when I was putting the video project together, I was trying to email a bunch of people, like, what's the real history of this?
Yeah.
And I was not getting a good answer until I found this one sort of white paper that was really not well indexed in Google. That's why it took me so long to find it. And basically explain the history and Henry Ford, invents an automobile, which is fantastic, right? I mean, you certainly
the mass markets the automobile.
Brilliant stuff. Yeah. Exactly. So then the unintended consequence of that is you've got a whole bunch of horses that don't any longer have a job. And soon after Henry Ford invented the automobile, World War I broke out. Not invented the automobile, but invented
the mass production of it.
Exactly.
Yep.
World War I broke out. So then there was a natural sort of demand for all these horses. They were going to go over and fight our wars. So that was fantastic for 4 years, except for the ones that got blown up, I suppose. And then at the end of the war, in Europe, their agriculture had been decimated. So the guy that was buying up these horses for the war effort switched to buying up the horses, slaughtering them, and sending the meat over to Europe to help feed Europe, right? So that's kind of how factory-scale slaughter began, at least according to my research. And then when that market dried up, he pivoted. That's kind of one of these sexy business terms we use these days. They probably didn't use them back then. Pivoted, switched his market to pet food in the United States. And that's why a lot of people think horses go to dog food or something like that. Pivoted to the pet food market, up until about the 1940s or 50s, when proper product labeling came in, that demand fell off because people didn't want to buy horse meat for their dog.
I want beef and lamb.
Right, exactly, exactly. But the other interesting thing was, once you sort of the excess work horses and transport horses were butchered for the pet food, this enterprising chap who I think actually has English origin, so it's quite embarrassing, shifted his supply to the west and picked up all these wild horses. So you had 1 million wild horses out west. You could get Mustangers to round them up for $3 a head. And they became the product in this system until, like, I think about the 1970s, some legislation now came into effect where you couldn't actually do that anymore. But the history is actually kind of interesting, I think.
And the wild horses really are ones that were let go. I mean, right. they trace themselves to the Spanish coming up through Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole other big issue in the horse welfare side, horse slaughter on the one hand, but also the treatment of wild horses on the other hand. And one of the big debates is, are these horses truly wild? And from a purist standpoint, they're not wild. They're feral horses. But they date back to the 1500s when the Spanish came over. And we did have our own indigenous wild horse in, I don't know if it's prehistoric times or whatever, but that went when it extinct. But, you know, we have wild horses on BLM lands, the federal lands, on Native American lands.
Bureau of Land Management.
Yes, yes.
And also on Native American reservations.
And these horses are treated differently. On the BLM lands, there are certain rules in place. But nevertheless, when I was doing my travel that helped me put this video together, I went to Rock Springs, which I now know is in Wyoming. That's an inside joke. You'd have to watch my video to see that. They have these corrals where the BLM has all these wild horses. And I think they're corralled. I don't know if they're corralled forever or they're short-term or long-term, but it just seems somewhat ironic. You've got a boatload of wild horses penned in to no longer freely roam. So it's a bit of a sad sort of outcome for them, I think.
There are very few people that adopt these wild Mustangs. And as a result, I think we end up seeing people talking about, oh, they're eating up resources that we could use for cattle. Or, there are just too many of them.
I mean, the reality is, again, prior to Henry Ford, wild horses were a great resource for man in this country because if we had to fight a war, we can gather up a bunch of wild horses and use them. If we needed some more horses for transportation, we can gather them up and use them. Same for agriculture. So they were a fantastic resource. We had 1 million, 2 million of them hanging out whenever we needed them. We didn't have to look after them. So at the time that we didn't need them, they would stay wild. Fantastic. So now they're no longer needed for anything. But as you suggest, they also compete for grazing rights and grazing lands from the cattlemen and so forth. So the cattlemen and their lobbies, they want to get rid of the wild horses. Or, you know, that might be a bit harsh to say, but that's kind of what it seems to be. And then you have the wild horse advocates that don't have the funding that the cattlemen associations have, obviously, defending the rights of these animals. That have, you know, they're a big part of the iconic Western culture, right? Like, how was the West built? And, you know, again, these horses came over, the Mustangs, the Spanish, and so forth. So they're important to the cultural identity of this country, I think.
One of the things that you talk about in this video, which will be up at your website, which is?
AlexBrownRacing.com.
Look for the advocacy.
Yes.
Section of that website, alexbrownracing.com. But one of the points that you make in the video is that right now in America, we still have some people who are using a horse for work.
Yeah.
We do have some people like Morgan the intern who worked with horse as a pleasure animal.
Mm.
And we've got sport and wild horses. I mean, that's all we're using horses for right now,
right?
Legally in America.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, in horse racing, which is obviously my background, we have some good people doing great things. We have some bad people doing some dodgy things. And I go into this a little bit in the video, I think. Rodeo is the same. You've got some good people in rodeo and you've got some unscrupulous people in rodeo that are doing things that ultimately ship the horses into the horse slaughter supply chain. In terms of work horses, you know, out west, you've got still some ranch horses because their fields aren't the same size as the fields on the East Coast.
Right.
And I didn't really know that until I really traveled out there, right? I'm just used to hedges and fences and small acreage fields, and I'm thinking, well, why do you need a ranch horse? I mean, literally, there's a five-acre field. I could go herd these cattle. But when you get out there, I mean, obviously, you're talking swaths of land and whatever. So you know, the ATVs kind of started to replace them and so forth, but they're still used. But the Amish communities are also communities that use the horse. And they're very local now, you know, Lancaster, Pennsylvania from here. But they've actually encroached out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They're almost up in Fairhill, Maryland at this point, in terms of where I live, which is just down the road.
I think that one of the things that we forget is since horse racing is no longer a mainstream sport in America, we think it's all about the, you know, events like the Kentucky
right.
Derby and the Preakness and the Belmont, the Triple Crown. But there's all sorts of different kinds of racing all yeah. across the United yeah. States where the horses are treated totally differently in yeah. bush races and yeah. match yeah. races and quarter yeah. horse races.
And quite honestly, I don't think anyone's got a real good grasp on the breadth of racing in this country. And it took me a long time to get my head around all the different types of racing. But we have, you know, like you say, the highbrow racing. So Saratoga would be an example of that, Del Mar in California, but obviously the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup. But we have about, in the summer, about 100 tracks have live racing. And that's traditional track meet regulated racing. Then you have the fair meet racing, which is 2 or 3 days at somewhere in Oregon or 2 or 3 days somewhere in Wyoming or whatever. And then you have, like, I went to the Crow Nation Fair last summer. Fantastic. And they
that's
have
what those relays.
Yeah. And they have the Crow Nation Derby and these relay races. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. Completely unregulated because they're on Indian Nation things. So there's no jockey club regulation, no drug rules or anything like that. And then we have this match racing, and that's dodgy stuff. Completely unregulated in a lot of these Southwest states where you basically lots of gambling, so on and so forth. So I go into a lot of that in this video to try to give people an insight into the different cultures that are connected to the horse. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased. I try not to be too biased in the video, but I'm a little bit biased being anti-slaughter. But I get, to some extent, how the cowboy culture, for instance, which is heavily tied to the horse, might be pro-horse. They might like their horse, but they are not pro-Washington, D.C. So that becomes a whole nother factor. You know, the cowboy's this independent dude. They don't want any more regulation. They don't care what the regulation is, but they don't want regulation, right? So that becomes a whole different sort of avenue that we have to understand if we are then to decide, well, we're going to kill horse slaughter at a legislative level.
Alex, I'm really going to miss you when you go home to England.
Well, there is still the internet, Richard, so we can stay in touch. Don't you worry about that.
Folks, if you're interested in this topic, go to alexbrownracing.com and look for the advocacy section of his website. And it's a really very interesting resource he's put together. I suppose I shouldn't risk a wager with you on the upcoming Preakness, should I?
Let me just add one thing. I'm hoping there's going to be a Fairhill horse in Preakness, right? So this horse called Divining Rod, he'll be about 15 to 1. So if these Derby horses have had a particularly tough race, which some would say they did, I mean, Victor Espinosa whacked the bleep out of American Pharaohs. Yeah, I bleeped it for you. I didn't.
We appreciate that.
So Divining Rod might be an interesting outsider. The really interesting thing about Divining Rod, not only is he trained at Fairhill, but he's owned by the Jacksons, who owned Barbaro.
Oh.
So I'll be having a very strong rooting interest in Divining Rod. But I did pick American Pharaoh to win the Derby. And if we have a shot at a Triple Crown, I've got to root for that too.
Divining Rod in the opening odds was listed at 20 to 1. Who knows what he'll be at post time.
Nice. Stick 100 on if he wins. then come buy me some lunch. That'd be fantastic.
Alex Brown, thank you so much for stopping by Campus Voices.
Thank you very much for having me, Richard, again.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.